This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Polina Popova, and today we will be talking to Megan Swift about her book, Picturing the Page, Illustrated Children's Literature and Reading Under Lenin and Stalin. This book was published in 2020. By the University of Toronto Press. And so, Megan, can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Polina. Well, I'm a professor of Russian literature. I work at the University of Victoria, which is in Canada. And I teach all sorts of courses on the Russian Revolution, as well as Russian literature. And the time period that I'm a specialist in is the 1920s and the 1930s. And I'm just fascinated with this period in all of its aspects, not like its visual aspects, its literary aspects, the cinema from that time, the poster art, everything, architecture. And so all of my years of experience of teaching and researching in this area came into this book.
And Megan, can you maybe start with telling our listeners how you got to write the book, where the idea for the book came from, and how it all started for you?
How it started for me was with a problem that didn't fit, a little clue that something was wrong, and it was bothering me. And how it happened was that I was on a research trip to Russia, and I was sitting in the National Library, National Public Library, and I had ordered a copy of The Bronze Horseman by Pushkin. And for your listeners, The Bronze Horseman is one of the most famous works of Russian literature. It's written in 1833, but the version that I had ordered was illustrated by a very famous artist, Alexandre Benois, who is from the World of Art movement just pre-revolutionary, just prior to the revolution. And I was looking at the illustrations, and I knew that series really well, the illustrated series really well. I knew that it was a really long one. It had 33 illustrations. I knew that Benoit had added to it over the years, and I knew that it was really spooky, really supernatural, and frightening. Like, it was, these were amazing illustrations. But this particular edition that I was looking at was from 1936. So it's under, it was put out under Stalin. And I could see that someone had tampered with the illustrations. That's how I thought of it. Someone had tampered with the illustrations. Someone had taken some lots out. And so the story that the illustrations was telling was different.
Huh. Like, interesting. Like,
yeah, the visual narrative had been changed. So
you remember the original, right? The original number of illustrations. Some of them were taken out.
Yes. So I was comparing it to the copy in my mind. And I thought, somebody had a different idea in mind when they kind of brutally edited this series, the illustrated series, down. Meanwhile, they hadn't changed a single word of the text. The literary text was exactly the same. And so I flipped the book over to look at the publication information. And you know, Paulina, because you work with literature, that on the back of books, they have a tiny little notation of tirage, circulation. And they have, they very often note down what the series title is. And so I turned it over and it said, Biblioteka Szkolnika, School Child's Library. And so in my mind, this was one of the most terrifying poems, like its themes are madness and despair. So I was a little surprised that it had been put out for the school child. And I wasn't surprised after I finished this book project, but at the time I was surprised. And I also noticed that its circulation was 300,000, which meant something to me because I knew the average size for a book put out around this time was about 50,000. So all of a sudden I had a mystery on my hand, which was, why was this book put out for children? I needed the answer to that personally. Why was it put out in an enormous circulation? Why had the illustrations been tampered with? And why was, like, there's other mysteries involved, like Benoit had already emigrated from the Soviet Union by this time, was living in France. So he was not a person who in 1936 would be the obvious choice to republish. He should be persona non grata at this point. So all of these things that didn't fit inspired me to look further, and it started me on the journey of children's literature under Lenin and Stalin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It always fascinates me in the work of historians of literature, literary studies, scholars, that they work almost like the detectives. And it's not it is the detective work, right? What you did and what you started with. And it's so fascinating to me. Megan, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about general methodology of your book. And I know in it you mention previous studies of Soviet illustrations, and previous studies on the history of illustrations of children's books. But I wonder if you can talk about your own approach and how it is different from the previous studies.
Well, my approach, which I think is different from things that I've seen before that have been published in children's literature, was to take one work. And I tended to focus on works from the past. So things, works of what are termed children's reading. So that means works from the past that are now republished for a new reader. And very often when you have children's reading, the way that publishers refresh the work for a new reader is by adding illustrations, by hiring, commissioning a new illustrator. And what I did that was different is I took a single work and I showed how it had been illustrated over time, all the new illustrations that were happening over time. So it really brought forward how images that were very, very important to the Soviets for political and cultural reasons, like the image of the peasant, right, who is somebody who is supposed to be the beneficiary of the Soviet state, someone who is supposed to be doing better under the Soviets, like the priest, like religion, the Soviet state is officially atheist. So how do you depict a priest? Even if it's an older work, how do you depict it for new readers? Mothers, also they're going out into the workforce for the first time. How are you depicting mothers now? How are you depicting the Russian countryside, what it looks like? What about writers themselves, authors, like a famous writer like Pushkin, the father of Russian literature? How is he being depicted? All of these things come forward very, very, in a very, very interesting way when you look at how a single work has been illustrated in pre-revolutionary times, then in the 1920s, then in the 1930s, how is that same work illustrated in wartime? And that, it makes you realize how much the political culture influences illustrations, even for children.
Mm-hmm. So you basically looked at the journey, sort of, so to speak, of the illustration through time, right? Of the illustrations and the books through time. Right.
Exactly. So it's mm-hmm. almost exactly. So you can see the progression, mm-hmm. or the regression.
Right. I actually was both surprised and not by something that you revealed in the very beginning of the book when you wrote about the lack of decent graphics in the pre-revolutionary Russian children's literature, so pre-1917th or even 19th century Russian children's literature. And as a person born and raised in the Soviet Union and then in Russia, I wasn't surprised at all. I was more surprised as a scholar, but wasn't surprised as a person coming from Russia, because I remember some of the, you know, pre-revolutionary books being republished and reprinted in the late Soviet times in the 80s, and they were kind of boring. Like a child just knows the good book from the bad book, right? And they were kind of boring compared to the sort of bold and vibrantly illustrated books from the Soviet era, from like by Marshak or Mayakovsky. So can we, my question here is, can we then deduct just from this mere fact that the pre-revolutionary booksellers, editors, illustrators, whoever were involved in children's literature at the time, were much less politicized? They were not pursuing propaganda as much, not interested in propaganda, and that children's illustrators of the Imperial Russia were not, like you said, at the very heart of mass political culture, like you said about the Bolsheviks. And can you talk a little bit about what changed with the revolution of 1917?
Sure. So this is a really interesting question, because I agree with you that pre-revolutionary children's illustrations are not as good as especially the early Soviet illustrations. So early ones coming about for the first 10 years after 1917 are really incredible, right? Like you said, so vibrant, so stunning. And this really goes to the question that I get a lot from non-Russian readers, which is that they expect, their expectation about Soviet illustrated literature is that it's bad. It's not good because it's full of political propaganda. To them, those two things must go together. And in fact, this case shows us that it's the opposite. So pre-revolutionary literature is not as politicized. I mean, all literature carries with it the politics of its culture to a certain extent, whether it's foregrounded or not foregrounded. But in the Soviet period, of course, it's very much foregrounded. And at the same time, it's really top quality literature. A lot of the time, and especially the artistic work is really top quality. So that's actually can be quite surprising for a Western reader to realize. But I think there's a number of different things happening at the same time. In pre-revolutionary children's literature, you tended not to have the top artists of the day as your illustrators. They weren't participating in children's literature. And that really changed with the World of Art group, which is actually not a Soviet phenomenon. That happens before the revolution, like just around 1900. You have this group of amazing artists that just become really interested in book art. And you have an artist like Ivan Bilibin, who is doing astounding illustrations for Russian fairy tales. And fairy tales, of course, are not considered at that time to be only a children's literature genre. They're read and enjoyed by adults, and the same adults read them to their children who happen to enjoy the illustrations. So their dual purpose, their dual audience works, but those fairy tales, Russian fairy tales done by Bilibin, are of an incredible quality. And then you get another member of the World of Art group, Alexander Benoit, who consciously does a children's work. He produces his Azbuka, the alphabet, which once again is an artist who produces for adults and who produces for children and who becomes a specialist in book art and who really understands how typography goes together with the illustrations, everything, the whole way that you produce a book is important. But it's not mass culture yet. It's only for the elite. Only the elite can afford these types of very beautiful books. And so the Soviets take that, the concept of the children's book, and because the circumstances of the revolution had changed things, turned everything on its head, they really managed to attract the best artists into book illustration. And so the overall quality of book illustration is much better after 1917 than it was before 1917. So I think even though it is political, it's still amazing art of the highest quality.
And you know what you just said made me think of the argument made by Marietta Chudakova, which I think you actually go a little against it. Her argument was that because of the repressions, the purges, a lot of the 20s and especially the 30s, a lot of the really great artists ended up in children's literature and illustrations because they tried to sort of hide away, or, you know, it was a safe space. But I think you take this argument further or go a little against it, and you actually talk about the class, right? It was more, especially in the 20s, it wasn't necessarily about the politics going from above. It was something that was also going from below. Am I right? Or maybe I'm misunderstanding this.
No, I think that's right. And of course, it's true that artists, literary artists as well, like Mandelstam and Pasternak, tended to start to participate in children's literature, as you say, as a safe space, because children's literature seemed to not be as patrolled as much by politics. But that happens a little bit later. It's in the first years after the revolution. These artists and these writers were all friends. They all hung out together. They all knew each other. The avant-garde was a very vibrant place where art was created, and I think that many of these artists were very happily creating alongside children's writers. Like you've got the Tchaikovsky Vladimir Lebedev partnership, right? And you've got the Kanashevich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tchaikovsky partnership. And these are like wonderful partnerships between top level artists and top level writers.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now I would like to discuss your argument about a Soviet picture book for children being, so to speak, a revolutionary medium, like you call it in your book. And I thought that was really important. So I was wondering, can you please talk about Soviet children's books and the immediate post-revolutionary times after the death of Lenin? And can we also, since you already touched upon that, but can we also relate that to the 30s and compare the 20s to the 30s, the epoch of Stalinist Cultural Revolution, probably mid-30s to late-30s, right? These two epochs often are compared by the historians of Soviet literature and Soviet culture, so I wonder if you can do the same for our listeners. And finally, it goes along the same line. More generally, Megan, what do you think? What historical periodization can we use when describing the history of illustration of the Soviet children's literature of the time?
Sure. Okay. So to your question about the revolutionary medium, I think a couple of things are happening at the same time under Lenin and under Stalin. What's happening is that there are publishing practices that have never existed before that have now become a reality. So you have children's literature, children's publishing as a mass phenomenon. So I mentioned it before that if before it was to have top quality books, it was mostly for an elite market, so for families that could afford an expensive book for their children before the revolution, there was a true effort made to have these books produced by top quality artists and writers reach into, they said it at the time, into the very depths of the country, right? And I think that the Soviets were successful at creating children's literature as a mass phenomenon for the first time. So that in itself is revolutionary, right? What I discovered the further I researched the book was that, and as I was observing how these images of the peasant and the priests and so on had progressed or had changed over time, was that the Soviets were really obsessed with managing the past and managing the literature of the past. And for them, that was a really big problem, how to handle this literature of the past. Because on the one hand, they didn't want to, although there were certain factions that said, let's just not reproduce the literature of the past at all. But that was not the winning line. The winning line was let's pass the literature of the past along to new readers, but let's be very, very careful about the narrative that we attach to this literature of the past. And so it actually wasn't permitted for an artist to illustrate a children's book, or any artist, not even just a children's book, any illustrations. You could not just illustrate it as a period piece. So for instance, you could not get a commission to illustrate Anna Karenina and then spend all your time reproducing the drawing rooms of the 19th century and the dress that a woman of Anna's class would have worn at the time. There was actually a cultural directive that disallowed this because that was considered to be a narrow yes. But also it was called being retrospectivist, and you could not just depict the past simply as the past. You had to find the connection to today, in quotation marks, to Soviet times. And so artists had the task of doing a real balancing act of finding today within yesterday, which was sometimes not very easy. And as to the question about periodization, I ran into this problem when I was trying to think about what the subtitle for the book should be. So I really wanted to have illustrated children's literature under Lenin and Stalin, but I had an early reader of the book say, what does that even mean under Lenin and under Stalin? And I understand the question because when you, as you know, you're an historian, and what you have the period that we call under Lenin, but Lenin dies in 1924, and then you don't really have Stalin consolidating power till 1928. And so you have 4 years of under Lenin where Lenin isn't even alive. And so it's complicated, right? It's complicated. But what I was thinking that for readers, especially non-expert readers, will know that will recognize Lenin and Stalin, and they'll connect in that way. And for us, the specialists, we might have our own, we might have a whole range of other questions. If I was asked to do my own specialist periodization, I would say that children's literature, when private publishing houses like Raduga, the Rainbow Publishing House, yeah, they produced incredible things. When the private publishing houses were existing alongside the public ones in the 1920s, that should be its own period. And then in the early 1930s, you have a big change where the state basically takes over all publishing, and you have the establishment of universal public school education. You actually have a literature curriculum that is reaching everybody. You have the creation of literature textbooks for the first time starting in the mid-1930s. That should be a different period, because what's being produced in children's literature is being produced with different tools now. And then I would argue that the wartime period is also a completely separate period, because the themes that come to the fore, the what's considered to be important for children as preparation, or as how what as the way that they're supposed to be responding to the war, is different. But that's way too long to put in one subtitle, so I stick with Under Lenin and Stalin.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I actually like that about your book, because it's so often the titles of books are so dry. They would be 1917 to 1953. And as you said, again, for the outside reader, can be confusing, or they cannot understand right away why 1953, right? So it's, I thought it's great, Lenin, Stalin. It's very straightforward, and both specialists and non-specialists can understand what we're talking, what it is about, right? You know what? I'll jump then to the question I have later on my list, but I'll jump since we're touched upon the school curriculum, and we already spoke about Pushkin. I was wondering about that educational aesthetical shift of the 30s and then the 40s, and especially about the wartime literature. Do you think that the historians and literary scholars might find parallels between the time of the third Stalinist Cultural Revolution and later World War II or Velikaya Отечественная война, the 40s, and nowadays Putin's Russia with its, or at least Putin's Russia during the 10s and early 2020s, with its militarization of childhood and resurrection of ideas of all kinds of martyrdom. These ideas are often channeled onto children and young adults through all kinds of mediums, starting with books and with advertising, whatever, propaganda. Do you think these two periods, which are almost 100 years apart, can be similar in a way?
I think that you have hit the nail on the head, and this is the work that is waiting to be written. So listeners who are poised to pick a new topic for their PhD or for their first book project, this is the one that is waiting to be written. Yes, there are definitely parallels that can be drawn between these two periods, 100 years apart, as you say, which is just incredible if you think about it. And I think that my attention has been drawn to this by our colleague in children's literature, Olga Voronina. She has drawn my attention to two cases that are very interesting. So the first one is this campaign by the United Russia Party, which is the leading party in Russia and the pro-Putin party in Russia. Their campaign to gather and collect children's books. And it's a program that's called Knigi Detyam Donbassa. So you take children's books, books for the children of the Donbass, basically. You collect them and you send them to the children of the so-called freed territories who have been, according to their narrative, deprived of the right to read in Russian. And they've even been sent into Mariupol and places like that. So you can see right away that children's literature is being instrumentalized as a propaganda tool. In a very interesting way. And for me, what has been fascinating is which books are being collected and sent. And so I've had a very brief peek at which books are being sent and which books are considered the very, very important, like, vessels of cultural knowledge that you would need to send to a child deprived of their... This is also in quotation marks that you can't see, deprived of their Russophone education, mm-hmm. right? And the percentage that are the Soviet classics is large. Yeah. And then, so a full analysis of this awaits, it awaits its scholar. But the second case that Olga Voronina has talked about that I think is really interesting is from 2018. And once again, we have United Russia campaigning to have a book that's called The Secret School of Young Heroes, Tajnaya Shkola Yunikh Geroyev, included in the national literature curriculum. So it's a newly written book. It's co-authored, which is also fascinating, by a 10-year-old boy and his mother. And in many ways, the plot of this book and reminds me of works like Tale of the Military Secret, Malchishki Balchish, right? So there's your Stalin era fairy tale about a boy hero who is protecting the values of the nation and who is called upon to protect those values up to and including his arrest, his torture, his death by firing squad. In this book, you've got a plot based around a boy hero who is fighting against a global virus that is infecting people with indifference and disloyalty.
Wow, sounds horrible. Yeah,
I know. And you have, so he joins a secret organization of heroic children who are expected to self-sacrifice. So here again, we have the martyrdom theme, which, as you know, comes to the fore during wartime with real life teenage heroes who then have these biographies that are created about them, like Zoya Kosmedemyanskaya, right? Like this young girl who was captured by the Nazis, and other young teenage martyrs, basically from World War II. And it's up to this boy hero in this 2018 book to conduct a special operation. And of course the word Spetsoperatsiya is now like a key word, because that's what Putin has called this operation in his invasion of Ukraine, to decontaminate the enemy's computer of this indifference and disloyalty. So there are absolutely important parallels to be drawn between what's happening in terms of militarization of children's literature in the Soviet Union. And Tale of Military Secret is pre-World War II, right? It's written in the 1930s. Arkady Gaidar, of course, is the writer, and he wrote several books that have child heroes who are also mini military heroes of the Soviet Union. So yeah, this is an important theme.
I see. Some stories that you describe in the book, when you read them, they're pretty mind blowing. So for me, for example, on page 25, I found that you mentioned how in the late 1920s, mothers were encouraged to become storytellers, сказочницы, right, for their children. So that it was a minor episode, but I was just curious about it. And that particular episode made me think of the Stalinist Soviet state as a whole. And I'm sorry, I keep coming back to the 30s. It's what I am fascinating with, the Stalinist state. So of course you can see it in my questions. But do you think that the state, or even Stalin himself, in a way became such сказочник? You mentioned about the state and the fascination of the Soviets with storytelling and changing of presenting history, but maybe we can really talk about Stalin himself, Stalin as a сказочник, because you also mentioned Katerina Clark in your book and her observation about the fantastic age in the Soviet literature. So can the same term be applied to children's literature and specifically to its illustrations of the time?
Yeah, I think so. And first of all, never apologize for being fascinated with the 1930s, because I share your fascination. So we can be we can share that fascination right together. Yes, the fascination with and the contradictory lessons and ideas around the fairy tale in the 1930s are absolutely incredible. So on the one hand, you have this very high profile group, the Podologists, which it's a crazy sounding name anyway. So Podologists are educative theorists who are maintaining that all literature has to be class-based, right? It's even though in English, Podologist sounds like they're a bicycling group, but but they are Soviet educative theorists. And then at the exact same time, like within a year of each other, you have these journals that are produced for mothers, Soviet mothers, that are encouraging them to become fairy tale narrators for their own children in order to pass on these values of the that are so important to for their children. And so it's absolutely, first of all, it's the fairy tale becomes something that's incredibly important, but also incredibly contradictory at exactly the same moment in history. And to say that Stalin was himself a master fairy tale narrator, I think is a very interesting way of looking at it, because it's true that if you can frame the narrative about what's happening, I mean, you have his famous motto of the day, we are, or it's a famous motto from a song of the day, we were born to make the fairy tale come true. At the same time that you have the terror going on and you have posters everywhere saying we were born to make the fairy tale come true and we have brought the fairy tale to reality, there's no more perfect definition of a fantastic age. And absolutely, children's literature is participating in that and is contributing to those images and those ideas. And quite possibly we have a second fantastical age that is emerging on our hands.
Right. Now I wonder if we can zoom on to one particular episode from your book, and that is a story of the evolution of illustrations of Pushkin's Сказка о попе и работнике его балде. So I wonder, it's a fascinating story. I wonder if you can share it with our listeners. But I also want to preface this with saying that that was one of the very first book from my own childhood that I remember, you know, like maybe I was 3 or 4, how my parents were reading it to me. That was the late 80s in the Soviet Union. And actually, after reading your book, I tried to find that edition because there were so many illustrations of this book and re-editions, but I couldn't find. So maybe it was some cheap re-edition from the 1980s or, well, anyway. So can you please talk about this particular work and its many illustrations from the pre-revolutionary Russia to the Leninist and Stalinist era?
Okay, I'll be happy to, but let me ask you, what did Balda look like in your childhood book?
I think he looked pretty much very like a Russian fairy tale, like, how to say, I think he was sort of big and strong, but he also looked very like Slavic, Russian, like blonde, stuff like that, like classical Russian guy. And maybe it also coincided with the popular, in the 80s, there was a rise of like Russian nationalism and in the Soviet Union. So maybe that's why, but I don't know. I don't remember.
So he was kind of wearing the embroidered blouse, mm-hmm. maybe the,
yep, exactly.
The boots looking very heroic.
Yes. Like, yes.
That? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So to start my story, I'll say that we know what Pushkin had in mind when about his what his peasant should look like because he sketched it. So this is the one case study that I have in my book where I know exactly how the writer himself pictured the characters in the books because he sketched his peasant and he sketched his priest. And what I found was that if you look at pre-revolutionary illustrations, you have a peasant who is middle-aged. This is this is the original versions. He's middle-aged. His shoulders are stooped from long years of hard labor. He is the same height as the priest. The priest is the one who is looking kind of crafty and dishonest in the original illustrations. And then over time, during the Soviet era, you have a peasant who is becoming, because the Soviets needed to show that the peasant was doing well, and because the illustrations had to connect with today and not just be renditions of yesterday, you have a peasant who becomes younger and younger and younger until he settles. He settles kind of late teen, early 20s, right? And he becomes more and more attractive. And he is standing up straighter and straighter and straighter with broad shoulders. He is not bent over from years of hard work. He's looking extremely heroic. For some reason, he's becoming blonder and blonder over the years. This must be the attributes of the typical Slavic look, right? The blonder and blonder over the years. And then he, at the end of his evolution, is standing usually at least a foot taller than the priest. And meanwhile, the priest is going through all kinds of changes himself in the way that he looks. So in the 1920s, he is changing rapidly. He is obviously the villain of the work, but sometimes he's kind of like a puny intellectual character. He has like little glasses on his nose. Sometimes he is enormously fat and overfed and obviously like living off everybody else's labor. But in general, the priest stays old and smaller, and the peasant hero just kind of rises through the decades and then stays that way. And one of the fascinating discoveries of the book for me was how much the images and just the way that children's works were placed at certain grade levels are all coming from the Stalin era. That didn't change. The images that were created in the Stalin era stayed. So the peasant, that image that you got during the Stalin era remained. And the years in which you were deemed the correct age to read a certain work were decided in the Stalin era, and they stayed. Like, it's really fascinating how influential the 1930s are for a lot of what came later in the Soviet Union.
And you also mentioned Konyok-Горбунок. Maybe you can talk about that case study as well. What was the evolution of the Konyok-Горбунок's illustrations? That's a book by Ершов, right?
That's right. It's one of the most famous Russian fairy tales, and it has a peasant hero as well, who is Ivan Durak, who's Ivan the Fool. And, you know, in early illustrations, shortly after the revolution, he is depicted very much like the fool. He basically looks like an imbecile in most of the illustrations, and he's kind of he's like that older teenage. Like probably 17, 18. He's a young man already. And as we go through the decades with Ivan the Fool for this particular fairy tale, he becomes younger and younger and younger at the same time as the story is being marketed. I mean, they wouldn't use the word marketed, but aimed at a younger and younger and younger reader, until he finally settles at about like a preschool age. He's probably around 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, wow.
Becomes
so
much,
he marries
much
at the end, right?
There well, is a this happy is end. This is what's awkward. this is what's very awkward, probably for the illustrator, is that he starts as this young child. So I think the idea was for the reader, the viewer, to sense the connection between himself and Ivan Durak, like they're about the same age. But you're right, at the end, he has to win the hand of the maiden and get married at the end, and you can't get married when you're 5 years old. So the illustrator has to age Ivan, you know, by like a very fast 10 years at the end.
Though maybe it was, you know, at the end, he jumps into this boiling water, the milk, maybe that
the milk
aged, aged him or something.
No, he's holding the hand of the maiden before he jumps, so he has to look older already. Otherwise, it's awkward. She'd be holding the hand of a toddler. Sure. But the horse is supposed to be tiny and deformed because he has got the hump. He's the humpback horse. And he also goes through this miraculous transformation over the years. So he goes from looking kind of like this strange, deformed kind of creature to basically having a pony makeover. So by the mid 1930s, he's got these bright, cheerful eyes. He's got the prancing mane. He is not deformed at all, that you can barely see the hump. It's a tiny little hump. And he's looking very attractive along the same lines. He's more like a toy, or a fun sidekick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And actually, this made me think of when you talked about the cultural importance that Stalinist literature and, you know, children's literature and illustrations still carry up to nowadays. I remember, that's a fun fact, maybe it's completely random, but when I first met my fiance, that my boyfriend at the time, his mom, my future mother-in-law, the first thing she told me, and she was probably showing off and trying to tell me how great her son is, she said, when he was 5 years old, or maybe 6 years old, he was reciting Konyok-Горбунок word to word from the beginning till the end. And I just so vividly remember this. Why, I don't know why it was so important to her, but Konyok-Горбунок and the fact that child could remember it completely. So it's still important. It's, you know, modern days Russia, and people still, you know, attribute great importance to this book.
Absolutely. I mean, Russian culture is a reading culture. This is something to be envied about Russian culture in our digital age, right? In the Soviet Union, they've called themselves the Sami Chitayami Narod, right? We're the most readerly people in the world. And there is a lot of educative status that's attached to reading. And Kanyak Garbunok is long. So for your, I mean, your husband could recite.
I'm not sure if it was true, actually.
he was obviously brilliant.
So now I'm just curious, and again, maybe this is a little silly and simplistic, but Megan, can you share who is your favorite Soviet illustrator and why? And also, speaking of illustrations, which, by the way, book has a lot of them, I really like this about this book. It almost reads like a fancy art album. So I really, really enjoyed it again. But I'm also curious about this, the images on the cover of the book. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, the images, first of all, I need to highly praise the art department at the University of Toronto Press, because I love that cover. I think it's so beautiful and it captures the aesthetic of the time perfectly. So this was one of the joys of researching and writing a book, is, and it goes back to your question about detective work. So when you start on a big project, you start working in the archives and you find all kinds of little gems in all of these strange places that you never thought you would find a gem. And the works from the 1920s and 30s are now designated rare books. So you have to have special permission to go into these places, and you have to be there in person. Like, you can't just get a copy of it sent through the mail or anything like that. So that your detective work is becoming more serious. And the cover art comes from a poster from 1928, and it's one of the posters that the state publisher used, and it's called "Что читать детям?" So, like, what I should read to my child, which is also this wonderful part of Soviet reading culture, which is the idea that there's certain works that will enrich your child's life, and you should be reading them to children, and you know it's worthwhile listing all these books and showing the book covers and reaching out to mothers and this, well, fathers too, but I think in general it's the Russian mother who directs the childhood reading. That and this what the book, my book cover, I discovered this poster, What to Read to My Child, and it's from 1928, and I found it in the University of Willamette in Oregon. Actually, it was I worked there before I got my job at the University of Victoria briefly. And it's my colleague, Mark Conliff, who said, I have something that I think you might be interested in. Who knows how that poster ever got there? Who knows why? It's the only one there. And yeah. And so I contacted the library and managed to get a copy of it. And then the art department just took those colors, those vibrant primary colors, and the images of like people who are running towards the future and, you know, holding the flag and reading and, you know, just this happy childhood, the image of the happy childhood with its books. I was really, really, really pleased with that.
And also the train,
cover,
which probably symbolizes the progress, you know, moving forward, right? And like
industrialization.
People of the north, right? I see the two Оленьи. It's fascinating, right? It has so many little images. So I've never actually seen this poster.
Oh yes, well, you'll have to go to Willamette in Oregon to see the original. But you were asking who my favorite illustrator is now, and that is a really tough question, because I think we've convinced everyone listening that the illustrators from this age were absolutely incredible, and their artwork was so beautiful. But if forced to pick a favorite, I'm going to choose Yevgeny Charushin. His work is so incredible. So he is well known for doing illustrations of animals, and he did this. He was a writer as well as an illustrator. So have you read any of his books, Charushin?
Yes, I think I saw a lot of them in the RGDB, Russian State Children's Library.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So when he does, he has this beautiful way of doing textures. So when you look at the feathers on his birds, or you look at the fur on the animals, there, it's so beautiful. You can almost feel like you could reach out and touch these animal figures. So he is currently my favorite, Yevgeny Charushin, but it's very, very difficult to pick because there's so many wonderful artists working in this period.
Mine is definitely Konashevich, but again, it's something for, I think, one of the first books that I read with my mom was illustrated by Konashevich. So the picture is really ingrained into my mind. And Charushin is amazing, I agree. So Megan, we've taken a lot of your time already. I really would like to thank you for answering my questions. And my final, very final question would be maybe you can talk a little bit about your future plans or the current project you're working on. Any plans for the new book? Maybe a book about Charushin or other illustrators.
Yes. So as you can tell, I'm still spending lots of time in archives looking at children's books from 1920s and 1930s, and I'm not getting tired of it. So my new book project that I'm working on is, it seems to me to be the sequel to Picturing the Page. So the idea is, what works from the Soviet period are still being read by today's child, and how is that selection process made? So a couple of things I discovered early on that were fascinating to me, which is that of the best-selling authors today in the 2020s, 6 out of 10 of them are Soviet. And so that's very interesting, considering that we are in a new ideological period, and that some of these concepts that are from these books, which may be almost 100 years old, might be a little old-fashioned or strange.
Outdated.
Or outdated, appear to be completely from a completely different period, but still these are being passed down to a new generation and newly illustrated. And that, once again, my fascination comes in with how are the illustrations connecting to today, meaning like actually today's children. How is the Soviet aesthetic influencing their life? And my idea about one of the first chapters has to do with how animals and nature are depicted. Because we're in a completely different atmosphere right now about our relationship to nature and the climate, but still these books, like, do you remember reading Lesnaya Gazeta?
That one, by Marshak, or what was it? No, I don't think so.
No,
maybe I just
forgot. It's by Bianchi, Vitaly Bianchi.
Vitaly Bianchi, right.
Yeah, so you've probably read some of his books about nature. He's a famous nature writer from the 1920s. And Lesnaya Gazeta is about, it's like a newspaper from the forest, of course, that's its name. But it's written by the inhabitants of the forest, who have these things happening at all these different times of year. So it's spring, we're building our nests. And it's so wonderfully written and so beautifully illustrated, and it's still being republished today for children, and I think it's delightful. But we have this completely different attitude towards nature and preserving nature now than the Soviets did. So to me, that's one of the fascinating questions that I'm hoping to get into.
That is super interesting. Again, thank you so much. Like, your current project sounds so great to me. I'm looking forward to reading your new book. And Megan, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed you talking about the book, and I hope our listeners will do as well. And again, thank you for coming to the show.
You are very welcome, Palina.